The South Downs are a more or less continuous hill that run along the south coast of England, east to west, from Winchester to Eastbourne. The first time I saw them, I remember being particularly unimpressed. Having grown up in the north of England, I'd lived close to the more dramatic landscapes of the North Yorkshire Moors and the Pennines. The South Downs, by comparison, seemed quite unremarkable. Low-lying, round and gentle. And the four rivers that cut through the South Downs are peaceful and meandering, unlike the rivers of the north that I'd been used to. But it's just that accessibility in human scale that charmed me. Over time, I found out how physically close the landscape is. In fact, we all more or less live on the South Downs in this part of England, and people have lived and walked on them for thousands of years. I became fascinated with the idea of imagining the landscape in the past, walking the ancient trackways that connect the villages, churches and barrows. The South Downs are an original highway, in the true sense of the word. The Wilmington Giant is on the north-facing slope of Windover Hill, near the Eastbourne end of the South Downs. He is, or rather was, a chalk hill figure, cut into the turf to reveal a white outline of a man, holding two long poles to either side in his outstretched arms. He's massive, over 70 metres high, and his outline is now made of blocks of concrete painted white.
You think I'm drunk, don't you? All of you! I'm not drunk! I'm not! You've got to believe me!
Please.
It was right in the middle of the highway, 30 feet tall!
His origin remains a mystery, and he nearly disappeared forever, as up until 1870, when he was first outlined in brick, the only records describe him as a faint green outline, a darker shade than that of the surrounding grass. He's facing north, overlooking the High Weald. At his feet is the village of Wilmington, and to his left side is the snaking Cuckmere River as it cuts through the downs and makes its way out to the sea, past Alfriston village along the way. I'm going to pay the long man a visit and spend a few days in his company, walking the paths that run at his feet and above his head to try and describe his place in the landscape today.
We'll walk across the hills and dales and look at all the farms.
Can't sing that, Keith.
Why not?
Doesn't sound right.
So it's a lovely sunny day here at the foot of Windover Hill, looking up to the Long Man. It's winter time. It's February.
It's cold outside.
You don't know cold.
I'm here with Anouk, who is my child, one of my children. She doesn't want to talk. She's running away. But she's here to help me today with the interviews. Let's have a look at this sign. Do you want to read it out, Anouk?
One of the greatest mysteries of the Sussex countryside, the Long Man of Wilmington stands 70 metres high, 321 feet. This is equivalent to the height of almost 40 men. The earliest known reference to the Long Man suggests the original figure was a marking in the grass rather than a solid line.
It's quite cool, like, someone came, they'd, like, if you usually, like, mention I live in Wilmington, like, someone say, oh, is that where the man on the hill is? It's quite indie. Yeah, it's... No, it's quite cool, because it's a man on it's a chalk man on the hill, isn't it? It's quite a big part of the village.
I was 17, in 1949. 68 years now, I think yeah. It was January the 8th, 1949, we moved here. The cottages were... pretty awful. There was no sanitation, no bathroom. Yeah. There was an old privy, which is still outside, with a bucket.
Yeah.
You know, and that was all there was. My father, in the First War, was in the Marines. Second War, he wanted to go in again somewhere, but he was really too old and he was in a reserved occupation. So instead of that, he went all over the country were building big grain silos. At the end of the war, we then lived in Eastbourne. And he said he wasn't going to come home because he didn't like the town, because he'd been in the country so much. He said he had to find a property anywhere in the country. One day my mum and I were out, and we looked in an estate agent's and saw this one and next door up for sale, with 10 acres of land the other side of the road. And we came out and bought them. And my father came home then. Otherwise, he didn't want to come home to the town again. So that's how we were. My mother hated the country.
Really?
Yeah, but she came out.
For him? Yeah.
For him, yeah.
Yeah.
When we came here, they were all villagers. They'd lived here all their lives, more or less. And now, of course, they've all been sold. They're not the same properties, they've all been done up. Really and truly, it's become an expensive village now.
Mm.
Instead of being just a normal village place, because it's so popular, because of the long man, it's not the farmers anymore. There's no farmers in the village anymore.
Mm.
A farmer up the road had a farm with his cows, and they all lived a long life, and they all produced lots of milk. And he said that, and he named every one of them, Buttercup, you know the names that they gave. And he said that because they could see the long man, that's why they did so well. And they lived such a long life and produced so much milk. And he used to come round with the milk, with a bicycle, with a sort of sidecar, with a churn on it. And he'd bring out his pint and his half pint jugs. You know, so you have to hold your jug out.
Mm.
And the funny bit was that he used to wear a Trilby hat. And if it rained, and he did that, all the water used to come down.
The story I always heard was that it was what the shepherds used as like a good, because he has the two poles, it's like a shepherd as like a good luck charm for the sheep, to look after the sheep. That was the one, that was the story I always got told.
You know what, when I first came here, what the villagers all told me it was, there were two giants. There was one at Firle and there was one at Wilmington. And they had an argument. And they threw boulders at one another. And the one at Firle knocked the one at Wilmington into the downs. That was the old story that I was told.
There was one, I think, was made like the Tudor time. One, some people said it was really old. But I'm not really sure, to be honest.
How old do you reckon it is?
1,000 or so years old, maybe two. Yeah, probably around there. For a religious cult or something, for like sacrificial reasons.
Maybe it was some sort of marker for like, to like say like a sacrificing ground or something.
I know a crowd of us. When we were young, we went up there one night. It was quite sort of mist. As you went up there, it got mistier and mistier, you know.
Yeah.
It was a bit spooky. It really was spooky up there. We came down very quickly.
Yes, I'm not surprised.
Yeah, we came down and then we were daring one another to go around the churchyard. Don't think anyone took it up after that. We were quite young then.
And the yew tree,
yes,
in the church here,
yeah,
is incredible.
Sure is. There's plans for work to be done on it, particularly replacing the struts, which is going to be jolly expensive. A bit of an engineering job.
I just saw on the notice down there that it's 1,600 years old.
That's the closest, yeah, estimate. Yeah.
And the church itself would be, it's Saxon, right?
There's a Saxon window, but almost all of it, as is, was built by the priory when the priory was set up in 1200 something or other. So there may have been a low stone building before that. But the tree would be pre-Christian Saxon times. So the church, if there was a Saxon church there, was built on this ancient site.
course, it's a living being. That's what I love. Say, for instance, about the U in Wilmington, is that it's what is it the certificate in the hallway of the church says something like 1,300 years, 1,300, 1,600, something like that.
I think it's 1,600 years.
1,600
yeah.
years.
Yeah.
And I just love, I remember giving a talk in India at a conference and saying that, you know, you guys are really lucky because you have an unbroken tradition, you know, that travelling, you know, thousands and thousands of years, you're still chanting mantras and reading texts that are absolutely ancient. In Britain, we don't have that, sadly. You know, the pre-Christian indigenous traditions were broken when Christianity came and everything changed. However, I can still, you know, in 20 minutes be sitting by a yew tree with my back against, you know, against a yew tree that's, you know, over 1,000 years old, 1,600 years old, that has this whole story. The church is 900 years old, isn't it?
Yeah.
So the tree was already
ancient
when they built the church, you know, so, and it's a living being. I can sit with a living being, you know, so...
Is it the place itself that has the power, or is it the use of that place that kind of brings the significance
to it? Yes. That's a really interesting question. I mean, I think if you ask yourself, you know, what is a sacred place? I think on the one hand, you know, we're always looking for one answer. With every question we ask, really, we're looking for the sort of right answer, you know, as well. But, you know, often we find that it's probably a combination of things and it depends on certain circumstances, a variety of answers. And I think there are obviously places which are aesthetically pleasing or awe-inspiring, at tops of mountains and in front of waterfalls and things like that. So they induce naturally a sense of awe and well-being. And so people would be drawn to them, you know. And then you factor in things like negative ions, the fact that, you know, by waterfalls, on mountaintops, by the sea, you get more negative ions, which are good for you and make you feel good and all the rest of it. Factor in geomagnetic fields. You get alterations in the geomagnetic field all over the place. And certain, maybe that's why certain places feel better. We're kind of... particularly if you're sensitive, you're picking that up.
Mm.
So it's not just the position of your house that makes you a man apart. You mean that it's supposed to be on sacred ground? I mean the fact that it's surrounded by ley lines. Sorry, I don't quite follow. But perhaps the original site was chosen because the ley lines form a sort of protective barrier.
Is there something inherently special in a place, or is it the use of that place that
makes it special?
Makes it special?
Yes. I think the two go together. I mean, it's a very special microcosm, the Cuckmere Valley. An awful lot of people come to walk or cycle all over the place. And one of the hidden gems, of course, is Little Lullington Church. I mean, for some reason, Lullington Church, churchyard particularly, is a very special place. It draws people there, and when I've it's not licensed for marriages, but I have done a blessing of marriage and a baptism there, and it's just the most magical atmosphere, which you can't really put into words. And I guess that earlier peoples were more sensitive to that sort of thing than we are, with everything going whiz bang round us and, you know, iPhones and the rest of it. The more sensitive to places being good or not so good, and the whole legend of ley lines and all that sort of thing.
Mm.
And then they were sanctified by use.
And then you have the way to it, which is important. Because whenever you think of a sacred place, you tend to think of the place.
Mm.
But it's also good to think about, how did I get to this place? The reason why we don't just sort of helicopter in there, as it were, is because actually it's about walking there and taking the journey. You drive on the A27 to Eastbourne, and you could be forgiven for thinking it's dull.
Yeah.
You know. And it wasn't until I started to walk the land that I appreciated it. Before, you know, I wasn't particularly appreciative of it. But then I walked to the Long Man from Lewis. A friend died. A friend died, and then another died a bit later on the walk, as it were. And it was when I walked the land, that's when I really appreciated it. And I also realised how important it is to walk around where you live. So when I'm in the town now, when I look, you know, the way when you're in Lewis, you can see the hilltops around. You know, I've been on those.
Yes.
You know, and I've looked back the other way.
So that was the voice of Philip Carr Gomme, who's the leader of the Bards, Orvets and Druids. You also heard Frank Fox Wilson, who's the priest at Wilmington Church. Also speaking was Billy, who's lived in the village for nearly all of his 12 years. And also talking at the start there was Pat, who's lived in the village now for about 69 years. We're going to move out of Wilmington and over the shoulder of the Long Man and down into the Cookmere Valley, past Alfriston and down past Hindover Hill and eventually out to the sea at Cookmere Haven. As we head down that way, you're going to hear a short chat that I had with Duncan Ellis, who's the director of the Long Man Brewery. So Duncan and his family have been farmers for generations in the Cookmere Valley. So amongst other things, he currently grazes the slope of Windover Hill, where the Long Man is situated. So I started by asking him where the idea came from to start brewing beer.
It was a Royal Wedding, May 2012. Having had a couple of pints, and a near neighbour of mine runs a successful beer and wine wholesale business. And we were talking, and we have a lovely story here. We've got a nice farm, we've got some lovely old flint buildings, a lot of history there. He came back to me and said, a week later, and said, you've got these buildings are empty and you're looking for something to do, do you fancy brewing beer? So 30 seconds later, we thought, yep, let's do that. That's an amazing opportunity. And we've been looking at the buildings at home, saying, you know, the right thing will come up. I'm not going to develop it to a house. I'm not going to develop it into an office. It's just too obvious. And they're too pretty for that. And I just thought we've got to be patient and wait for the right opportunity. And so with that, you know, that conversation was just definitely, we have to jump at this and grasp it. And then the debate came about, well, how are we going to brand it? Are we going to call it the Cookmere Valley Brewing Company, or are we going to call it whatever? And Steve just said, come on, we've got to use the Long Man. He's so iconic, and you farm him and you run the sheep on him, and it's just a lovely story. We started from there, and yeah, 5 years later, we're employing 15 people, sort of going great guns. When we looked to develop this brewery, we obviously had to get planning permission, and Wealden were not being terribly helpful. So I got Peter Bidmead, the late Peter Bidmead, who was my great archaeologist friend, to do some research, and he found reference to a brewery at Church Farmer in about 1630. There was a reference to a maltings and a brewery on site there as well. At that point, the plan had rolled over and said, go on, you know, get on with it. But it was, again, it's a lovely story for us, and lovely to kind of revive that lost art in the valley, I suppose.
Yeah, it's a fun project, and we've been quite clear, we just want to make it traditional drinking, beer.
I think the Long Blonde must have been the first one I had. It would have been at least sort of 3 years ago, so it must have been fairly near the start of.
It was the first beer we made.
Yeah,
Long Blonde. Yeah, it hasn't changed a bit since we started.
Yeah,
and it is very popular. It is one of our best sellers.
Yeah, it's a good name as well, isn't it?
We wanted to make beers that people know what they're drinking.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a best bitter is a best bitter, and a blonde is a blonde. And
yeah.
All right, this is a little bit of fun in there. We're calling it a Long Blonde, but. Yeah.
it's all a bit of light-hearted entertainment, really, and with reference to, obviously, to him. And it actually is an interesting debate, is it him or is it her? I think there was some, there was him as a figure is not a very manly figure. But when he was, obviously, he was remodeled not so many years ago, and whether that was accurate, I just don't know enough about that.
The earliest image that they've now found was on a map, and it's that.
Yeah, well, obviously that looks very male. That looks very male, doesn't it?
Yeah, he's quite sort of portly. The legs are splayed, and the feet are pointing. Both feet are pointing out.
Yes.
Which is definitely that's
what he's not now. Yeah.
What he's not now, and then there's some difference around the head and there's facial features as well.
Yes.
I don't think there'll ever be anything that can sort of confirm one way or the other.
I don't think it matters. I think as long as he's looking, he's there and he's looking clean and tidy and he's up together, he'll be there for a long time yet.
So you were talking about the latest sort of archaeology that was done on the site.
Certainly we were involved in helping. We provided the digger and a man to start excavating the top sort of, I think it went down to about 30 centimetres, just to look at the soil profiles and to see when they were last disturbed.
Mm.
Try and get some gauge to whether, how old he was, whether he was Norman or whether he was, you know, obviously a lot older back to the Neolithic times. And I'm not sure there was any clear evidence to suggest either way, really. I know, I think the more common thoughts are that he is probably not as old as we think.
Mm.
But it is a bit of a coincidence that you've got so many very, very ancient features there with the barrows and the flint mines that there isn't, and they wouldn't have put them there for any silly reason. There must have been some reference to him way back. I just think it's just too much of a coincidence for it not to be.
I mean, I sort of feel like if it was, you know, if it was like 16th century or something, I feel like there would be more, you know, there'd be more in the records somewhere. You know, someone would have written something about it, or because it must have been, it is an impressive monument.
I think it's an interesting point to talk about records. Burnt House, which used to be, or still is, in the valley, was burnt down. It used to be the village or the valley's record office, and it burnt to the ground. So there's very, very little information on the Cookmere Valley, and whether evidence of him was in there or not, we'll never know. But certainly, it's a great shame that we've lost a lot of the old documents.
This story about lost records makes a lot of sense when you look into the stories about the Cookmere Valley. It's hard to pin down or trace the origins of them. They twist and turn like the Cookmere River itself. I kept asking myself these questions. Why was I so preoccupied with identifying the facts? Why not be comfortable in the mystery of it? Whose permission do we need to bring to life a mythological landscape? What was I waiting for? These questions come together and are illustrated beautifully in the story of Anne Downes, a woman who probably rediscovered the Long Man sometime in the 1860s. A barely visible green man at that time, who would only be revealed to Anne's eyes at certain times of the year, when the light and weather conditions were just right. It's quite possible that without her vision and imagination, the Long Man may have been lost to us today.
Yeah. I love the story of Mrs. Anne Downes, who was a woman who lived there in the Downs, and she used to look out onto the hillside there, and only in those rare instances during her life where there'd been enough snowfall, where it had snowed, and then as it melted, this figure just emerged out of, just for you know, moments, hours, as the snow melted differentially across that landscape, that she would see this sort of hint of a figure who would just disappear. And that's all, you know, and when Reverend, what was it, St. Croix and Fenet, these two guys came and she told them the story, you know. And that's just perfect. I think this lovely idea of just this human figure just appearing just for a few moments, every so often, every five. I mean, when did it last snow to that degree? I mean, I don't know, 7 years ago, 10 years ago.
Yeah, and rescued by the maybe by her seeing,
by,
you know,
by her
story
seeing that.
And,
yeah.
And further down the valley, towards the sea, at Hindover Hill, there are stories about the Long Man's companion, a female giant. There's no evidence for this, but there are strange stories attached to the hill. There's a white horse there now that was carved not long ago. Duncan told me a story about this horse, that one day a hunter was up there riding. He fell from his horse and died, and the next day the white horse appeared on the hillside. Here's Philip talking about his own landscape dreaming around Hindover Hill.
If you take, say, the either the horse at Hindover or Hindover, around by the Cookmere, just behind the Long Man, as it were, or south of the Long Man, you know, officially the official history is that it was cut for a girl who fell from her horse in the 1920s, I think it was.
Mm.
But you know, there are stories about how the Long Man had his consort and the, you know, it was a female figure there, and there was a horse there. And you have Epona, the female goddess of the horse. And I remember when I was following that in looking for this female figure, you know, you walk along, and I thought it'd be hard to discern, but the landscape naturally forms the figure of a woman, you know, and you walk along behind the Long Man, and you go down Charleston Bottom, and you come out. And I was looking, trying to use every sort of sense to try and pick out what it is. And then I actually burst into laughter because there's a woman lying with her sort of legs slightly open, sort of there in front of you. And there's a little sort of tattoo of a white horse on her side, you know. So my feeling, I don't know if it's true or not, but my feeling is that, you know, okay, they may have cut that horse in the 1920s, but there was something there before that they, you know, either picked up unconsciously or there were some traces or remains of something before.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, I suppose that's why the White Horse of Uffington is so amazing, because from their studies, they're pretty sure it is thousands of years old.
Yeah.
You know, so we know that they made these chalk figures thousands of years ago. And, you know, I think, you know, what we probably all like to believe is that the Long Man and the Cernabis giant is also thousands of years old as well.
Mm.
But it is a mystery. We'll probably never know, really. Mm.
If you think of the whole Stonehenge complex, there was some stuff there way before Stonehenge.
Mm.
And it was, the area was sanctified by use, whatever particular use they, and eventually they made this amazing monument, you know, just stunningly over the top monument. And maybe, you know, why was Alfriston Church built in the sort of cathedral style in this small village in the Cookmere Valley? So clearly it must have been, you know, a special place. The amount of skill, time, effort and money, somebody or the community must have been inspired by that place to build it, I think. A number of churches locally are built on old mounds, which may be man-made mounds. One is Alfriston. Another one is Hellinglie. Mm. And possibly Wilmington. Mm.
I started this podcast in the winter, and I've ended it now in late March, on one of those amazing spring days when it feels like the summer's arrived. And I can see, walking down along the side of the Cookmere River, how beautiful this part of the world is. But what about places that are less pretty? Is it asking too much to try and bring a story to life in a place that has been built over or forgotten about and left to ruin?
Yes, I mean, we can we can sort of, I think we can, you know, we can damage environment so that it's much harder to access. The image I have as I'm talking of it is sort of seeing somebody sitting on top of something that's incredibly layered, and that these sort of layers of history and of sort of subtle energies and of story and meaning and all the rest of it, and we're sort of living on the top of it without really appreciating the depth. Like, how old does something have to be? Or if I came out with a little sort of pithy, wise saying that you found helpful, you know, whether I actually just thought of it in the moment as I said it to you, or whether actually it's 100 years old, 1,000 years old, 2,000 years old, how old does it have to be before something is appreciated or taken seriously? And it's quite funny because in Britain, because we have such a history, as it were, that people can even say that modern Druidry is inauthentic because it only has a recorded history of 300 years.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, in America or something like that, 300 years is a hell of a long time. It's like positively prehistoric.
Yeah.
You know,
there's nothing apart from the Long Man. There's nothing, as it were, spectacular about the Cuckmere Valley, except it's all spectacular. You know, and if you go down to the next seat, and especially when the sun's in the right place, and you go up the hill, as it were, towards Eastbourne, and you look down across the Oxbow Lakes and down to the estuary and so on. And, of course, the iconic picture with the Coast Guard cottages and the Seven Sisters is on the front of Bill Bryson's new book. It's, you know, you just keep walking there and you'd never get fed up with it, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's quite cool, but you don't really kind of notice it that much if you live here in Wilmington. Yeah, the Druids come once a year.
Looks to me kind of like a traveller almost, because, like, with two staffs, like, maybe because maybe, like, a man was hiking up that hill with, like, two sticks, and so, like, they wanted to kind of represent the kind of, like, that he did that, and it was an amazing thing.
Nobody knows why.
Why it was built, what on earth, what on earth was going on in somebody's mind to do it. I mean... Yeah.
To gather the kind of, and it must have required a group of people to do it. It can't be.
Yes, and what are those rods? You know, why? Yeah. Why are they? Why is he standing? And is it a he anyway?
Yes.
You
know,
my mum used to do B&B, and she had someone staying here who was interested in the Long Man, and he used to spend hours and hours up there and sorting things out. Now he said that underneath this Long Man is a serpent. Different people that come out find or seem to find different things about him. And why did the person that stayed here think there was a serpent underneath there? You know? Yeah, I don't know. He's always just been like that. Mm. You know, from the time I used to ride over the top of him and till he is now. But what the truth is, I don't think we'll ever know.
Thanks to everyone who gave up their time to speak to me, and a massive thank you to Belinda, who introduced me to most of the people in this episode. Please go to the website, which is monumentpodcast.com, for links and images about the Long Man and the work of some of the people I've spoken to in this episode. If you enjoyed listening, please subscribe using your podcast app. There will be more episodes coming along in a slightly haphazard and random way. Next episode, I head north to Yorkshire and Teesside. Thanks for listening. Bye.